different age groups. I remember one day I was traveling down and I stopped at a school and I talked to a kindergarten group. I also talked to their junior high group and then their high school group. And then I was going down to speak at a retirement home. And I thought, in one day, I just covered like the gamut. It was absolutely wonderful. And I do believe this, that the Bible is really simple. And it's, yet it's so profound, we can talk about it forever. But I really think that the basic principles in the Bible, anybody can understand once they are at an age where they can't understand. We don't have to make things more complicated than they really are. We do that naturally, make it complicated for some reason, like the tax code. Right? Is the tax code complicated or what? I have a master's degree, and I can't read the stupid thing. And my dear wife would have to get on my case if she heard me on the phone, because sometimes I'm not very kind on the phone, or at least I'm trying to be kind, but it sounds like I'm not, or something. And I might say things like, I have a master's degree, you need to write it like so I can read it. And I would be glad to give you whatever you want. Just make it so I understand it, please. And then she would be telling me, give me the phone. Forget it. She does our taxes now. I don't. I can't handle that. I am so thankful that God made things simple enough for me to do in his world and in the world that we're supposed to live. He didn't ask me to do something I can't do. And he made it very clear to me what it is. And so I'm very thankful for that. There's no big loopholes or tax things I got to know. There's no maybes, almost. I'm thankful that it's simple. And really, as I talk to you, as I get a chance to do that, I'm going to start and then I'm going to end on Sunday with you. I just want to talk to you about how we can be a catalyst for change. Because if you look at our nation, we're not doing well as a nation. And we need to begin to take a look at what's really going on. I love the prophets, and I love reading about the prophets. I love reading the prophets. They're different. I mean, Micah might have been termed as the prophet of mercy if you read the book of Micah. Habakkuk, he might be the prophet of faith. Lately, I've been into Joel, which a lot of people aren't into. But he's more the prophet of judgment, unfortunately. I'm not really afraid of judgment, except for, here's a couple things that I know. We as a nation are really headed towards some rough times, because God cannot bless what we're doing. And I don't know if people actually realize that that's what's going on. Think about what's normal now in our country. Think about what's normal. And the simple question is, can God bless what's normal here? Can he bless the idea of abortion and what's going on in that area? Can he bless homosexual marriages? The answer is no, by the way, in case you're wondering. But what's really weird is when you look at this stuff, can God bless greed? Can he bless pornography? Can he bless a nation that is doing these things? And do any of us read the Bible where we see that he cannot bless this, where he says, I will not bless this? And then we're part of the nation. So as I look at it, I'm going, God, I feel kind of helpless here. Because there's no way that you can bless what's going on. So what am I actually going to do? How am I going to prepare for the future? Because here's what I know for sure. Unless we have a nation that repents, we're in trouble. So what do I do? Because there's no way for you to bless it. And I don't want to pretend that you will. I want to be prepared for what I need to do. If you understand, I mean, some of us say, well, yeah, it's not as bad as it really is. You know, 63% of single Christians that responded in a survey basically said, yes, we know that we're not supposed to be sleeping around before marriage, but we do anyway. 63%. That's a majority. Somehow they segmented something. They've said, I can sit and sing worship songs, and I can be a part of a church youth group, and I can even be a leader, and then I can go and have a different segment where I can go do something that God says, no, you shouldn't do, and I can do that. And then I come back and sing a worship song again. Now, is anyone else driven nuts by that? I mean, that shouldn't happen. But we do it. And the funny thing is, it's being done quietly, and it's almost acceptable. But it's not acceptable to God. There's no way for him to bless that. When you think about normal in general, how do things get from where they're the way they should be to a normal that's all different? Well, the first way, if you study sociology at all, the first way things move from, you know, where they are and should be to something deviant is that those people who know what's right are silent. That's it. That's the first step. So if somebody came in my presence, some young person came and said, yeah, I love God, whatever, yeah, I'm going out with her and I'm sleeping with her, and I say, oh yeah, well, I don't want to really bug you, so I won't say anything. In other words, I'm silent. I don't say anything. But if I grab them by the collar and say, what are you doing? Now, see, I can get away with that because I'm an old football player and that's what the coaches used to do to us. So I'm used to that. See, if I don't say anything, what happens is they believe that the behavior becomes normative. Because I didn't say anything. I'm the authority figure. And in our nation today, when was the last time someone got up in national news, you know, on the federal level and said, look, we got to stop this abusing women thing and this pornography thing. We got to stop it. It's evil. It is wrong. When's the last time we heard that? See, we don't hear that. So because of the silence, it becomes normative. Not only that, it's not a complete cycle then. It's just the silence causes the first step. The final step is when those who actually hold the right conviction, they become the new deviants. So when I stand up and I say that homosexual marriage is wrong, I become the deviant. Now it's changed. Now normal has changed. It's not complete until that other cycle. So people today who might stand up and say they think that abortion is evil, what happens is they become accused of hate crimes. Why? Because now they're the deviants. Now, when that happens, the normal changed. And in our country right now, if you stand up and say things like, I believe that marriage should be between a man and a woman, it should be a committed relationship, it should be for life, you become the deviant. And that's why I know normal has changed. Where pastors have to give written notice of their sermons and people are listening to see what they say. You see, they're becoming the deviants because they're saying God made us a certain way. And I look at it as just Joe Normal and I'm thinking, hello? Didn't God make us a certain way? I mean, really, I'm not a rocket scientist or anything. But I think there's a big difference between men and women. Just saying. I don't really think I'll ever know what it's like to give birth to a child. I'm not made that way. I'm never going to understand that. I will never understand the bond that my wife has with my children. Never. I will never understand that because that bond is different than mine. These children were part of her. See, I don't get it. Here's what I do know, though. It doesn't make her better and me worse. But I don't understand it necessarily. Here's what I do understand. She's a woman, I'm a guy. And God made it to work that way. And anything other than that is deviant. I shouldn't be called a deviant for saying that. All science is on my side. And God is on my side. So I don't know how these guys come across saying something else. Now, maybe I'm just too simple-minded. I don't know. But all I do know is there's a bunch of stuff. Tolerance. Think about it. God isn't tolerant. We start thinking that tolerance is a Christian attribute. It isn't. How in the world can we watch somebody destroy themselves and be okay with it? How can you watch somebody hurt themselves and say nothing? That's evil in and of itself. See, somebody wants to make that a good thing. Democracy. Say, boy, yeah, I know. Take little sound clips from here and you'll get me thrown in jail, probably. But democracy doesn't do anything. Democracy is a bunch of people that try and decide what's right. That's not it. Democracy just tells us what a bunch of people say. So the majority of people say this. I'll bet you if you went into the all of Wisconsin and all of Illinois and you polled people on their favorite football team and the Bears would win. There's more people in Chicago. That doesn't make anything right. I mean, that proves that. Hopelessness is something that happens all the time in our country. And nobody stands up and says, look, that I know why you're hopeless. You see, you were made a certain way, and if you're going to deviate from that way, if you're not going to live that way, then it's not going to work. I had a young man come to me. His sister actually dragged him, if you want to call it that. She called and said, could you meet with my brother? He's on a suicide watch. Sure. I'm thinking, God, what do I say? He came. We spent yesterday. We spent about 3 hours together. It was a precious 3 hours. I don't know what God did in this young man's life, but I tell you, when he left, he kept chasing me to say thank you. And basically, I told him, I said, look, you've tried all these different things. They don't work. When do you want to know what does? You're not going to find what you're looking for where you're looking. God made all of us to be people who so desperately want to be significant and secure, and we cannot find that. That's a gift from God. And until you understand that, you will look and you will look and you will look and you will wear yourself out, and it will not happen. Are you ready to allow God to give you that? It's interesting that there's some things that are mutually exclusive that we try and make not mutually exclusive. Mutually exclusive is of or pertaining to a situation involving two or more events, possibilities, in which occurrence of one precludes the occurrence of the other. In English, it means two things that can't happen at the same time. For example, you can't be wearing a completely red shirt and a completely green shirt. If it's red, it's not green. If it's green, it's not red. There are things in life that are mutually exclusive. Let me ask you this. The basic understanding of life, is it about God or is it about me? Which one is it? Okay. Theologically, we might agree on that. So is that how it is? And let me ask you, is your life really about God? Or have we become very clever at making God and our relationship with Him about us? And about wanting to twist things so that we are the center of the universe somehow. It's really interesting when I start thinking about this, because my brain goes nuts trying to figure this one out. And my brain goes nuts on a lot of things. But this one in particular, because it's like, God, shouldn't I want to love you for this, for what it does for me? And I wonder, wait a minute, am I making this really just about me? Do I have to make everything about me to make it work? What if it's not about me? What if I don't make anything about me? What if I'm wired to really make everything about Him and you and not me? What if when I do that, I'm fulfilled? What if fulfillment and significance and security are a fruit of something rather than what I do? You see, I do know this, that if I try and make it about me, it never works and it's never really the way it's meant to be. And if I try and make it about God, I can mask it trying to make it about God and still make it about me somehow. And what I have to learn is exactly how God wired me, and eventually get to the point where I say, God, my life is really about you. Because when Jesus was asked what's important, he said, to love the Lord your God with all your heart and all your soul and all your mind, and to love your neighbor as yourself. That's all he said, and then he was quiet. You would think that Jesus understands how we're wired. And if I'm going to be okay, I need to live in the context of how I'm wired. Not rewire myself, but to live in the context of the way I'm wired. And I am wired to love God. And he tells us what that means. It means obey him. And to love you. That means I need to live in a way where I want you to be successful. Imagine a world where everyone you met, starting in your own marriages, your goal was that the person that you met today, starting, obviously, if I'm married, that would be Linda, and seeing her first, my goal is, God, how can I in my life make this woman successful? What do I need to do? And God, would you show me today the people I need to meet? And all day you hunt for people and things that God wants you to do to make other people successful. What kind of world would we live in at that point? You wouldn't have to lock your door. You wouldn't be worrying about pornography anymore. I tell the young people I work with all the time, you have a pornography issue, what you're willing to do is just use people and toss them away. No, we're not. Yes, you are. That's what it is. And God didn't design you to do that, so you will never be okay doing it. In Joel, it says this, "Yet even now, declares the Lord, return to me with all your heart, with fasting, with weeping, with mourning, and rend your hearts, not your garments. Return to the Lord your God, for he is gracious and merciful, slow to anger, abounding in steadfast love, and he relents over disaster." And I think, God, if there was a verse that I could share with our nation, this would be it. Why? Because if there's any hope at all anymore, it would be because the people of God and the people of a nation would repent. Not outside, but inside. That we would understand that rending our hearts is a private act that has public consequences. Rending our garments is a public act that has little or no private consequences. See, that's the difference. I can get in front of you all I want and talk about how sorrowful I am for my sin, whatever it else, and I could have nothing change in my life, nothing. Or I could actually rend my heart and you will see in my life a change. You see, it's interesting how many times we in evangelical circles think that because we've been taught or we've heard or we know something that that's good enough. It isn't. We need to act upon what we know. If we do not act upon what we know, then why do we know what we know? It makes no sense to know anything anymore. I don't know if that made sense. I used the word know too many times. But in the process, see, if God wants to teach me something, I need to be able to take it and do something with it. It's not that hard. He said, you love me, obey me. Let me ask you this. Do not raise your hands. But let me ask you. How many of you in this room have ever intentionally, you knew what you were doing, disobeyed God? No kidding. I read all your minds. You know how dangerous that is? To go against somebody who loves you and knows what's best for you and has told you and you say, no, I don't want it. You know, it's one thing to be ignorant. It's another thing to be willfully disobedient. And in America, to whom much is given, we are willful, disobedient people. In the church especially, we know what God has said. And when we don't listen, we are deliberately or intentionally pushing that out. And what we need to do is stop that and say, I am wrong. Not, you are wrong. Not, I need to say, I am wrong. It is not my job to fight this battle. It is not my job to change the United States of America. That would be God's job to do that. My job is to not disqualify myself from him using me should he choose to do so. That's all. And the way you disqualify yourself is by being intentionally disobedient. Why would God use somebody he can't trust? And he knows that from before the world began. But my goodness, in my life, what I need to do, my dad, when in 1981, we moved up here and started the year-round work. I just finished 47 years being here, believe it or not. And in 1981, we moved up here, my family. And my dad eventually is the guy who founded the ministry, and he turned it over to me one day. And here's the honest truth. I still don't know why he did that. I was like the least qualified person you'd ever meet. I had only one thing going for me. I was his son. And anybody that was around at that time period would have told you, yeah, he only has one thing going for him. He was related to the guy who started it. True. But you know what that did? It put me at the front of the line. And here's what else happened. I've always been a compliant child, a personality problem. But I always have. I always wanted to listen. Never got a spanking growing up, because if I disappointed my dad, I was so disappointed, I just would cry. And he was wise enough, no, you don't need a spanking when that happens. You know what was really interesting? It's not that I was very qualified to take over, but I never did anything to disqualify myself. And when it came time for my father to choose his successor, he chose me. I'm still touched by that. Not because I earned it. I still don't know what I'm doing. But the thing is, he trusted that I would do the best and make the best decisions. I did not show him that I would disobey intentionally down the road. We had a young guy once. I worked with a youth club in Antigo, and we had a young guy, he's probably 8, 9 years old. You might have heard this on the radio. I don't know if I've said it or not, but it was kind of interesting because he went, and one day he did what a young boy does. He climbed up onto the roof of the church, and it's a big flat roof on the school. He climbed up there and just thought, that's cool. Went up a gutter, you know. Wow. Came down. It's no good if you do it. If you're a young boy, you understand this. There's no crowd. Got to go get a crowd. You know, you can't do this kind of thing without a crowd. So he went and he got a crowd, and then he did it again, right up. And everyone's going, ooh, this guy's cool. You know, and he's up on the roof, and while he's there, he sees the roof, these flat roofs have stones on them. So he took the stones, and he started dropping them down the pipes. You know those pipes are supposed to be pipes, not full of stones. But he liked the way it sounded. So he's going, he's dropping down his pipe. Oh, look, he filled one. Filled another one, you know, just filled him with stones. And on the way down, he slipped, fell, broke his leg. Busted. Now, this was a big deal for some people. He's been in our club, and all of a sudden I got told, hey, by the way, this guy climbed up, filled it with rocks, and I go, are you kidding me? That's hilarious. Like, it wasn't hilarious, I know, in some respects. I mean, his parents had to pay for getting the stones out of the pipe, and I mean, all that stuff. I understand all that. But he was just an ignorant, if I could use that word, boy. He didn't know that this was all that dangerous. He does now. He learned his lesson. Now if he did it again, that'd be willful. Before, it was just like, are you kidding me? Do you guys realize that we all live in a fallen world? And that we are sinful? I'm sinful. And guess what? I married a sinful woman. We're both sinful. What hope do we have? Only the redeeming factor of God, only the gospel. Only the fact that God is working. Only the fact that as God reveals things to me, I can actually now listen to him and actually get it right. That's the hope I have. I don't have any hope of doing it right without that. I need to be in the Bible. I need to know what God says. I need to listen to him. And what's being said in the book of Joel is, you got to rend your hearts, man, not your garments. This public display of Christianity stinks. It doesn't work. And not only that, it doesn't affect your private life anyway. You need to start with your private life. Your private thoughts, you need to start there. And when things aren't right, you need to say, God, things are not right. I am wrong. And guess what? You're not surprising God. Not only that, the whole time, nobody's ever had a private moment in their life. And the whole time that you thought you had a private life, you haven't. And God has loved you all along. He wants you to listen to him. And when you don't, the reason it breaks his heart is because you can never achieve what he made you to achieve unless you do. It's for you he does it. Not for him. He's God with or without you. He doesn't need the hassle, I don't think. But he loves you tremendously. Rend your hearts, not your garments. Return to the Lord your God. Why? Because he is gracious and merciful. Because God's plan is not to be punitive to anybody. Oh, there will be punishment. But God's a God of restoration. He loves it when we come back to him. He loves when we say, God, you are right, man. And he goes, I know that. I'm glad you know that now. And it's not because he's being arrogant. It's just he is right. interesting that it's not very popular for preachers today to get up and actually say anything. My wife knows how frustrated I am sometimes by sitting in a service and I just heard a message and I can't figure out why he said what he said or what I'm supposed to do with it. I want to know what I'm supposed to do. Leadership has to lead. People do not want leaders today, though. They don't want to be challenged. They want to be affirmed. You know, the Bible should challenge you. When you go to the Bible just to constantly get an affirmation, you're not going to get anything out of it. You need to go to the Bible to be challenged by what it says. It's not that you won't be affirmed at times. You will. And God knows how to do that, by the way. He knows how to do that in the right way. But the Bible should challenge what you're thinking. Not just always make you feel good about what you're thinking. There are many passages. I mean, I'm supposed to love Linda like Christ loved the church. I was like, really? I mean, honestly, really? Yeah, did I make that not clear? What part of that sentence didn't you grasp? Well, I understood it. But really? Can't I give you reasons why maybe... No, what part of that sentence didn't you grasp? What, God, you shouldn't ask me that. I grasped it. Whatever the word is. Yeah, I made that pretty simple, didn't I? Do you realize that God tells me to love? He commands me to love. Do you ever see people say, I hope I fall in love? Well, he commands you to love. All right, now I got to back everything up because what do you mean command? You mean you, yeah, figure this. Now, don't put this in the context of wives and husbands, please. This is a, God tells us to love our enemies, doesn't he? You know what's interesting about that? It's an agape word. Agape your enemies, not phileo your enemies. Do you know that you cannot phileo an enemy? The word wouldn't fit. You can only agape an enemy. Phileo is simply, I'm in this for me, basically. I have a relationship with you because it's convenient for me, it's good for me, so that you can't do that to an enemy. Wouldn't work. I tell you what I can do. I can look at everybody, I can look at an enemy, and I can say, I want what's best for you. Even if you're my enemy. Now think about that. As a husband, God says, Dave, you need to love your wife like I love the church. And what did Jesus do for the church? That's my example of how I need to love Linda, right there. I don't need to worry about the rest of the world at this point if I'm not doing that. You know, when my marriage isn't what it should be, it's because I'm an idiot. I have that rule. That's where I start. 99% of the time, that's the reason, too. I'm either being self-centered, I'm all about me, whatever it might be. You can't have a good marriage and do that. And I'm not going to be looking for Linda to change. I'm looking for me to change. I don't care what she does. I need to love her as Christ loved me. And there are many times where I have deliberately or intentionally not listened to God. There are many times where I've not done what I should. There are many times where I probably should have disappointed him to the max. And he welcomed me back. And looked for good and reconciled with me. As a husband, I need to do that as well. As a wife, she needs to do that with me. See, somebody who cares about the people. 2 Timothy 4:2, preach the word. That's what they do. They know the Bible because that's the only truth we know. Be ready in season and out of season. Reprove, rebuke, exhort with complete patience. And teaching. Do these things. If you're going to teach, do these things. If we're going to talk to people in our nation, let's do it. It starts with reproving, rebuking, exhorting. This young man I told you I talked to, I had to go through this process. Well, reprove. Let's take a look. Let's reprove what you're doing. How's it working? Not so good. Yeah. Life stinks, doesn't it? Yes. You know why? Because you are refusing to listen to God. You are refusing to allow God to be your father. You are refusing to live life the way it was made. Are you ready to do something different? That's quiet. Yes, I am. Let's get on it. Now comes the exhort part. You see, good teachers don't just camp in one of those. We do all three of those. Think about it. Leaders who are about God Leaders who are about God. Those they lead, then, are about God. See, if you as a leader are about God, then those they lead need to be about God. Because that's all they are concerned about. Some people have asked me, how do you know if you should follow, have a mentor to follow this person, whatever. I said, here's what you do. Go find people that they've mentored before and who actually listen to them and see what their lives are like. Don't find anyone that they've mentored and won't listen to them. That doesn't matter. Go find people that actually they mentored and who listen to them and see how they're living. If everyone is about me, leaders will abuse their power and followers will abuse their leaders. You know, if I'm a leader and it's all about me, you know what I want to do? I want to manipulate you. I want to use you. I want to make sure I'm okay. I want to use my power, my authority to make sure that whatever I want is taken care of. See, that's abusive. And you know what? If you're all about you, you want to use me as a leader for you. You want me to somehow make your life better with my power, my authority, whatever, and before you know it, it's like in football. We talked about, you know, you lean on me, I lean on you. We both look good in the films. That's not how it should be. In Jeremiah 5:30, Jeremiah said, an appalling and horrible thing has happened in the land. What is this appalling and horrible thing? The prophets prophesy falsely. The priests rule at their direction. My people love to have it so. But what will you do when the end comes? Look, we have a nation where when in Wisconsin, when homosexual marriage, when the Supreme Court did whatever they did, and by the way, the Supreme Court is not supreme, but just keep that in mind. But whatever they did, the first church that the first place I heard say, yay, finally some good, was the Church of Christ in Green Bay area. Saying, finally, we're treating people right. And I'm going, a horrible thing has happened in the land. Because right now the prophets prophesy falsely. And the priests rule at their direction. And the people love it that way. Think about all the abuses in history from leaders who are just trying to appease the people. Think about if indeed a leader needed to appease people, what does he do? He works at convincing people of what he's doing. Who did that well? Hitler? See, Hitler didn't believe he would answer to God. Because he didn't believe in God. Oh, you say, what about, no, he used religion, whatever else, but he did not believe in God, and he did not think he was going to answer to God. So where did he get his power from then? The people. So where did he spend all of his time? Manipulating the people. Why? Because that's where he got his power. Where did the Apostle Paul get his power from? God. Where did he spend his time? With God, explaining to people who he was. He won in the end. You see, we need to be able to understand that a leader is only worth their salt and only worth following when they are following Jesus for real. And we need to hold them to that. And the only way you're ever going to know that is by knowing the Bible yourself. And as you know the Bible yourself, when somebody says something, you're able to look at it and say, I don't know. One of the most important things, I want to give this challenge to everybody here, one of the most important decisions I ever made in my life was to read the Bible through every year, cover to cover, at least once. That was for about 30 years ago. And I haven't broke that since I made that deal. It is the most singular, important thing I do. Why? It puts things in context. I can understand life the way it was supposed to be. I know what to do when sin shows up. I understand that I am a sinful creature that needs a constant flow of God's grace. It doesn't surprise me the realities of life that we're in. I understand what God has said. If we do not know the Bible, we will be open to all kinds of people that teach it incorrectly. And that's a very dangerous spot to be. I am convinced that many of those I talk to that are Muslims actually don't know what they believe anyway. If I'm talking to those who are Catholics, they don't know what they believe anyway. If I'm talking to Baptists, they don't know what they believe anyway. Most of the people I talk to don't know what they believe. But they do believe. Think about that. What do you believe? You have a belief system? Yes, I do. Where does it come from? Grandma. What if grandma's wrong? Are you really about God? Do you really love him? Why would you love him? Why love God? Because you were wired to. There's something, 2 Romans 1, there's a way you were made. You were made to love God. The Toby Mac theology. You were made to love him. You were. And if you're not loving him, if you're not obeying him, there is no way for you to be okay. You're not going to function correctly. The one thing you should do more than anything in the world is spend time with God. You know, I was talking to a young man. He came to me, and it's a more distant mentoring relationship. And every once in a while, we get to connect again. And he's a young man that's doing a certain job, and he was in another state for a while. And I met with him. I said, "So how's it going? Are you in the Bible?" He goes, "No, I'm struggling." He knew that was the wrong answer. I want him to be truthful, though. So I said, "Really, why are you struggling? Tell me about your day." He said, "Well, I get up at 5 in the morning, and you know, I got to get to work." And I said, "So when do you get home?" "We usually quit about 3 or 4. "And what do you do then? Because you're in another state. You're not even home. What do you do?" He goes, "Well, we usually go out to eat." "And then what?" "Well, motel has cable, you know." I said, "So you go back and watch a movie all night?" "Well, several." I said, "Stop it! What in the world are you doing? Do you mean to tell me you're not in God's Word, but you watch hours of movies? What is wrong with you?" "I know, Dave. I won't do that again." Believe it or not, that's how he answered. Why? Because he realizes, I'm his buddy. What in the world? He's right. He's not feeling right. Things aren't going right. He's not in the Word. What is your problem? Stay away from that stuff. He said, "Well, what else do I do? Everybody else is doing that." "Does this place have a lobby?" "Yes." "Do they have couches?" "Yes." "Go sit in one. Bring something to read." You know, you can't start talking to somebody that way. I would only talk to somebody that way who I've been mentoring and love, and they know I love them. They know I'm not going to run from them. But how in the world? See, I told you, what becomes normal? What if I would have said to him, "Yeah, it is pretty rough. You work all day, pretty tired. I bet you just want to chill out." I had a wife come to me once and say, "You know what? My husband doesn't talk to me much anymore. He just, what does he do?" He says, "Well, he comes home from work, and guy's a pastor, and he comes home from work, and he's, you know, got a lot on his mind, so he likes to play video games, and, you know, I got to give him chill time." I said, "No, you don't. What's this chill time stuff? What is that? Do you mean to tell me that before he'll spend time talking with you, he needs to go in front of a screen?" "Yes. Let's talk about this." "Why?" "You see, here's what I know. You are telling me as an older Christian something that's going on, and if I'm silent, it becomes normal. I cannot be silent at that moment because I know that it will become normal because you look to me for leadership. And if you're looking to me for leadership, what I got to do is tell you that's not going to work. That's all." Now you may say, "Boy, that's very arrogant. I don't even want to come talk to you about anything." Well, if I don't know you, I probably am going to be softer at first. I'm not a counselor, by the way, so I don't know how to do that soft stuff anyway. I was tested. I don't have any empathy at all. Ask my wife. However, see, in the context of a relationship, those of us that see things that are happening that should not happen, we should say something. Why? Because God made it so that we can be okay only the very specific way he made us. And he made us to be with him. What does Satan work at the most? To keep us from him. How? Distracting us with busyness, other stuff. Stuff that becomes more important. What is more important? Interesting as we go, do we really love people? is another question I have. I mean, do you really love people? One of the things I want to solve, you know, our young ladies are growing up in a culture where I think they're being abused in a very terrible way in every way. We are so over-sexualized as a culture that it is a tragedy. That's the best word I can think about it. One of the things I'm asking the Nicolet Bible Institute boys to do is try and get in the habit of every young lady that they see and every young lady in our class. I want these young ladies to understand that they are respected and loved and protected by us and not abused and hurt by us. And I want them to get in the habit of looking them in the eye. And when they look them in the eye, I want them to say a quick prayer. God, help me do what is best for this young lady and make her the best person she can be. Start there. And I told the girls, if you start seeing his eyes move, you take his chin and move it right back up to your eye. Why? Because we need to have somebody say there's a better way to do this. If I am going to be silent and watch these girls go through the pain that they're going through because of the culture that wants to abuse them, then it becomes normative to them. I am not saying that we all need to go out there and do what I do. You're not all in the position I am. But I am saying that if we remain silent, then it becomes normal. People need to start hearing that it's not right to do this. We can still love them and tell them that. If you were to ask the young men, you can ask Todd later if you see him. He's been one of the young men I've mentored, and I've beat on him pretty good at times. And yet, he keeps coming back. It's not like he's tied or anything. He doesn't have to. He can leave. But I don't think that I'm after Todd in a hurtful way. I'm trying to help him be the successful young man that he can be. I don't know how to do that in every area. I don't know anything about music. I didn't know the little box they were playing up here. I can't help them there. I can care about them, though. 1 Peter 2, it says, "But you are a chosen race, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, a people for his own possession, that you may proclaim the excellencies of him who called you out of the darkness and into the marvelous light." I am not like those people that are living in darkness. I am not like them. I do not have to act like them. I actually can enjoy my marriage. I can actually enjoy the fact that I've been married 34 years. I keep thinking that marriage is like the best thing God ever invented. I can be faithful to my wife. I can be respectful to her. See, I don't have to live like the world. I don't have to put her on a car to try and sell a Corvette. I don't need to do that. Let the Corvette sell itself. You see, I can be different. I don't have to be like the rest of the world. Because I'm not like the rest of the world. And Peter's saying, look, you're different. You're chosen. You're called out of darkness. Once, though, you were not a people, but now you are God's people. Once you had not received mercy, but now you have received mercy. What's the idea here? Act like it, would you? What in the world are you looking at all that they're doing? How in the world can we fight the battle around? People are so afraid of legalism in a way. It's like, are you kidding me? Look, if you don't have a relationship, then it is legalism. But within a relationship, in the context of a relationship, rules are not legalism. You know, I'm not going to get in a car with another woman and drive anywhere alone. Oh, Dave, that's legalistic. It is not. I have a wife, 34 years. And believe me, I am going to be very careful about how I portray anything that might hurt her in any way. And I have made a commitment to her that I will not travel alone with another woman, ever. I will not take another woman out to eat. If they're going out to eat, it's just me. I'm not doing it. Why? It's not necessarily totally evil. I understand that. But in my life, I have a relationship that means everything to me. And I am going to guard that with the rules that I put in place because of it. That's not legalism. Legalism is putting the rules there and hoping you have a good relationship. See, once I was not one of the people of God, but now I am and I need to act like it. I tell the kids all the time, I've been married 34 years. I act it. Why? Because I am. I love God. I want to act like that too. I'm going to obey him. And when I'm wrong, I know that he knows that. So it's no big surprise to anybody. It's no big surprise to you. It's no big surprise to Len. It's no big surprise to God. I can say, I am wrong, see? And I know I'm still loved. Beloved, I urge you, as sojourners and exiles, abstain from the passions of the flesh which wage war against your soul. What is it that wages war against your soul? The passions of the flesh. Believe it or not, this Esau moment kind of stuff, this urges of the flesh, they wage war against your soul. You should not be controlled by your passions. Let's just take a look at this for a second. The words, urge. Peter comes and says, I urge you, I beg you. When's the last time you had a leader get in front of you and say, please, please, for your sake, please, do not do this. This young man that I was talking about, watching, I looked at him eventually and just said, look, I am begging you, don't do that. Do you know, it was really cool, his response, because he could have just got mad at me. Instead, he said, Dave, I won't do that anymore. I will go into the lobby. Hopefully, they'll come with me. I'll have a book. We'll talk. Good. I'll see you in a couple weeks. I want to see if you do this. If you're going to be a leader, go ahead and urge people to do right. You know, do it within your context, your personality. You're not me. You've got different personalities and different opportunities. Do it within that context. Sojourners. What is a sojourner? Why am I called a sojourner? Because I'm a temporary resident here. Why am I acting like I'm a permanent resident here? I mean, eternity. Boom. That far, forever and ever. How big is my life that's average life, 70 what years? How big of a dot is it on that eternity line? Why do I keep focusing on that? This isn't home. Ask anyone who served our country in another foreign combat zone. They weren't having parties. There's nobody there setting up a party all the time in the middle of a war zone. I had friends who fought in Nam, and I have a guy who told me for weeks he was in the same foxhole. It was his bathroom, it was his living room, he couldn't get out, his friend died right in there with him. He wasn't partying. He wasn't looking to invest in property. You know what he wanted to do? He wanted to win that war and go home. That's what he wanted to do. Do we understand that we're sojourners and exiles? Why do we try and live as if we're part of this when we're not? Don't you think that would be frustrating? Don't you think if I was in Vietnam and I wanted to live as a part of that during the war, they're napalming things and I'm trying to set up a tent? Don't you think that's silly? Abstain. We know what that means. Abstain from what? From the passions of this life, the urges, the desires that want to get you. You know, it's really interesting when you see in our lives how many things just grab us and control us. Most of them are just our passions. We don't know what to do with them. Like, I don't know what to do with it. How about saying no to it? Well, since, do you even know where your feelings come from? I mean, honestly, do you know? What's your favorite color?
Blue.
Yeah, I don't like blue. But you do, that's fine. I'm more of an orange guy. Blue and orange I like. But you know what? He looks at blue and he goes, ah, blue. I look at blue and go, who cares? I look at orange and go, ah. Now, what, why? What makes you like blue?
I have no idea.
Nobody knows. You just look at it and somehow everything goes, cool.
No idea.
Food, same thing. I mean, I eat something. Like, I love onions. My wife hates onions. I'm looking and go, why do you hate onions? Like she knows. Oh, I put it in here and everything goes, yeah, you know, I don't know. Do you realize that we don't know where feelings come from, but we let them control us? And then Satan goes, really? That's really easy. All I got to do is give you something in your life to get you an urge and now you're done? Because you don't know how to say no to yourself? One of the things I asked the college kids to do here throughout the year is if they would listen to me, I want them to practice saying no to their urges and desires. I just want to practice it. And they go, oh, you're legalistic, whatever. You know, I want them to practice it. Because I think if you can't practice this, you'll never be any good at it. So I tell them, when you go back after a class and you want to eat a candy bar, Snickers, grab it, look at it and go, I'm not going to eat it. Put it down. I remember one year, a guy 3 months later came and said, I did it, Dave. And I look at him and go, what? I put the candy bar down. Took you 3 months? Good for you. I'm happy. Do you realize how many people really don't understand it just because they have an urge in their lives? They have an urge and they have to satisfy it. They don't know, they don't even know they can say no. They can't live their lives and have an urge that's unsatisfied. This wages war against your soul. That gives Satan a playground that's so big. There's no way that you should live in a manner where your passions control you. Jesus condemned that. God condemned it. Esau is the one we look at. Guy comes in, there's porridge. I'm really hungry. I'm going to die anyway. I might as well eat that. It's not the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Esau. It's the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Our passion destroys the flesh. You know, you say, Dave, we get the idea. This is how I study. I just try and understand the words. It's not like it's hidden or anything. I'm just working with the words. My soul. The passions of this life, I can start zeroing in on, and before you know it, they're destroying me. Because I'm trying to find the significance and the security in those passions. And the minute I'm done with a passion, the minute I'm telling you, the minute I eat a hot dog, I want another one. The minute I take a piece of pizza, I want another one. Why? It did not satisfy. When will I be satisfied? With pizza? Never. I told my wife when we got married, it doesn't matter how many pieces of pizza you have there. I will finish them. I don't care how big it is. I've never known any of my friends to leave any pizza. My wife even figured this out about men. I don't know if it's right or not, but it has been proven in our house. That if men come over, whatever she puts out will disappear. Doesn't matter. If she wants to lose a lot of cookies, she puts a lot out. If she wants to lose a few cookies, she puts a few out, and the men never complain. Whatever's out, goes. Women will always leave one. Men will eat them all. You see, that's interesting. It's passion. She knows. Men come in, food. What happens is eventually we have consequences to those passions. We start seeing that they control us, we start losing in this life and in the next because the passions are what controls us. Matthew. But he turned and said to Peter, get behind me, Satan. Jesus said this. You are a hindrance to me. Peter. Isn't that guy that was talking earlier? Yeah, but later. See, earlier, but later. Earlier on my slides, later in life. Get behind me, Satan. Do you believe Jesus called a guy Satan? Why would he call somebody Satan? Because Peter was doing things that's characteristic of the evil one. What is characteristic of him then? Would I do that? For you are not setting your mind on the things of God, but on the things of man. Whoa, God, like I do that all the time. Yeah, Dave. That's of Satan. Satan wants you to start thinking only about the here and the now. He wants you to have those Esau moments on a continual basis. He wants you to be satisfied only by your urges. You see, it's really hard to be self-centered if you listen to God. But if I could just bend these things a little bit and twist them, I could still be self-centered and kind of follow it. I can be almost kind of following Jesus, kind of, sort of. And for most times, I could be satisfied with that because you and I could get together and say that's okay. For you are not setting your mind on the things of God, but the things of man. Then Jesus told his disciples, if anyone would come after me, let him deny himself. Take up his cross and follow me. You want to follow me? Deny yourself. Quit thinking about you all the time. It isn't about you. You start thinking about me and others, and you quit thinking about you. Why? Because there is no way for you to follow me. There is no way for you to do it any other way. And I made you to follow me. So you will be frustrated all of your life trying to find something you cannot find. You will be looking for significance in all the wrong places. And you'll never find it because I just want to give it to you. And I want to give it to you only when you follow me. Because there's no way for you to reach your potential unless you follow me. There's no way for you to do it. See, he does everything because he loves us. Not because he needs us to do anything. God doesn't need us to do anything. He does it for us. Deny himself, take up his cross, follow me. For whoever would save his life will lose it. You want to keep thinking about you? You want to just keep thinking about how you're going to take care of yourself? You will be miserable. Promise. Why? Because you weren't made to do that. Christianity can never be made popular. It always calls for self-denial and self-sacrifice. I can never stand up in this country and make Christianity popular. Why? Because it's not about me. It's not about our country. It's about us loving God and making sure the people around us are cared for. Yeah, but who's going to take care of you then? You got to take care of yourself. Do I? What, am I my own idol now? Do you really think I can take care of me? Or is it God alone that can take care of me? I can start acting like I have to take care of me. But what if I can't? What if I can never take care of me? What if it has to be God? I've had several interesting health issues, from heart attacks to blood clots that have put me in the hospital that just about put me out. I suffer from narcolepsy. You know, things can change in an instant. And I'm not in control of anything really important. I am so glad that my Heavenly Father who loves me is the one that's in control of everything important. And as long as I stay by Him, I'm okay. As long as I'm loving Him and listening to Him and loving you, I'm okay. Doesn't matter what happens. I can't take care of myself. I don't have the ability to do that. I have to let Him take care of me. And the more I try, the more it's just my pride. And I got to get before God and say, God, I keep getting in the way, don't I? I keep getting in the way of you caring for me. I mean, I don't have the time. Tomorrow I'll give a tour if anyone wants it of camp. But I'm telling you, every building in this place, everything in here, this place was started in 1967 by my father who walked the grounds and saw that this would be a great place to reach children. And he borrowed the down payment. We are now 47 years old. We have no fundraising people, no PR people. We depend on $6,000 a day, 365 days a year to stay alive. This is a story of God's faithfulness. And tomorrow He could change it all and we not be here. I understand that. Do you know how much I get in the way sometimes? I remember one year I was frustrated because, God, we don't have the money. I don't know how I'm going to take care of things. I know I'm supposed to be in charge. But I don't know how we're going to do this. And we were way behind. I think it was December. We were 200 and I think it was, I can't remember exactly. So I'm just 211,000, I think it was. 210,000, something like that. And I even gathered the staff and said, I'm not sure you're going to get paid. It's Christmas, sorry. I don't know what we're going to do. I've never seen us in this position before. I remember I was sitting on the couch in my office and I was crying out to God. I was saying, God, what am I doing wrong here, man? Do I not have enough faith? And it's almost as if God beat me over the head, saying, so this is about your faith, huh, Dave? You've made this about you? Somehow? Well, God, I'm in charge. So it's about you now. Right? And I realized right there at that moment, God, forgive me. Forgive me. I've made this about my faith instead of your faithfulness. Please forgive me. A couple days later, I got a call from a guy, a retired guy that's not in good health, and he called me and he said, Dave, he was on our board. He's a guy put on our board because he drives through this camp in a red car, and he prays. That's all he does. And I said, I want you on our board. Like, because you pray. I want people who pray. So he knew the situation. He called me and said, Dave, I don't have much money. But I was sitting here this morning praying, and I just kept thinking, God, if I could get together $1,000, would you pay the bills with that, please? And he said, Dave, tell me the truth. Do you think I'm just a nutcase? And I had to think for a second. And I said, no, I don't think so. I said, if God put it on your heart, you know, here's me, though, getting in the way again. I'm thinking, I don't want to take this man's money. He doesn't have any. See, I'm thinking me again, right? I'm not thinking God can use enough. I'm not thinking any of that. I'm thinking totally wrong at this point. I'm thinking about human. But it took a while, you know, right away my head's processing. I go, no. Here's what's true. If God puts it on your heart to give, give. And we'll see what he does. Next day, he has Parkinson's. You could hardly read. And I could hardly read the check, but it was in my mailbox. We cashed it. Nothing came in. It was about 2 weeks to the end of the year, and all of a sudden, money started coming in. It came in unbelievably. And on January 1st, we had $212,000. $1,000 extra. $1,000. I called him. I said, would you like your money back? Amen. We have $1,000 extra. He said, nah, keep it for something frivolous. I thought, yeah, you know, why not? Do you know how cool that is? Now, I want to share that story with you because even in my position, as I've been here for years, I keep wanting to make everything about me. What I understand, how I have faith, how I think, I'm trying to make it about me. And God keeps breaking me of that, saying, Dave, it's not your faith. It's my faithfulness. Hey, Dave, it's not about you figuring out how this guy's going to live. It's about me taking care of this guy. Hey, Dave, I put it on his heart. Would you shut up? I want him to do this. I want to provide for him. Would you just stop with the stopping him? You see, the more I want to make this world about me, even in the disguise of making it about ministry. And that's how clever I've been through the years and how clever I think the church has been. We have been so clever at disguising things. We have made church about us and family about us and faith about us. I don't know how many times I've been to me and said, you just need more faith. Really? Yeah, God, you know, uses amounts like mustard seed. Do you ever think that he meant if you had any at all? Not more. Maybe I don't have any. I think I'm distracted by what I see rather than being determined by what I know. You see, it's so easy to be distracted by what I see rather than really be focused because of what I know I should be doing. In 2 Corinthians, it says, so we don't lose heart, though our outer self is wasting away, our inner self is being renewed day by day, for the light momentary affliction is preparing us for an eternal weight of glory. How in the world can people go through affliction in this life? One of the things I told this young man that came to me that was fighting depression, I said, you know, first of all, let's get our definitions right. I mean, first of all, I said that probably 100 times to him, so there's a lot of first of alls. But let's understand something. We misdefine things. We actually think that joy or happiness is defined by the absence of pain. That's not true. Guess what I mean? Well, you, for example, what do you do when you really can't bear it, you know, the pain? I go drink it. There you go. See, what you want to do is get rid of the pain in order to be okay. Now, it doesn't work that way. In fact, what God has done, in fact, you can never love somebody unless you're willing to live in pain. Why? Because love is painful. Check it out. If you love somebody, I mean, my wife and I have talked about this because I've been laying in a hospital bed and the doctors have said we don't know, and we've talked about separating at some point by death. I hate that thought. if she dies, I may. See, it's all about me anyway. But if she dies, I am telling you, I'm going to be in pain. So sometimes I think it would have been better never to get married in the first place. Because I don't want to go through that one day. And you know what? There's a lot of people that do that. They build up these walls and they refuse to be in loving relationships because love always yields pain. I'm sorry about it. It's the way it works. You cannot love somebody and go through this life without being pained by them. When your children make mistakes, when your children get hurt, when your spouse gets sick, you are going to be pained. And you cannot say, I will not allow that in my life. That is a good pain that builds you up, and running from it will only make life worse. Yeah, but I'm going to live without pain. Well, then you're going to have to live drunk, stoned, and a bunch of other ways that the world is doing it right now. Because that's the only way to get rid of it. Or you can embrace it. What did Jesus do? He embraced it. The pain did not scare him. And he understood that it would take pain to redeem his people. See, never try and get rid of pain in order to be joyful. I'm not saying go out there and go, I hope I'm painful. No. See, there's good pain and there's bad pain. A young person comes to me and they've hated their dad all their life. Their dad has abused them, etc., and their dad dies. And they say, good, I'm glad that old man's gone. That's one kind of pain. It's not healthy, by the way. That's destructive pain. There's another one that comes to me just recently, whose dad died. And she was talking to me saying, he was such a good dad. I'm going to miss him so. And she was pained. And I remember looking at her saying, enjoy that pain. Why? It was brought by a memory of love. Wow. That's a good pain. When I was in football and I got injured, I would have to rehab. I remember once I was rehabbing, the rehab person said, ooh, don't do that. That's bad pain. And I remember making a wisecrack because I always did. Pain is pain. I don't want any of it. Now, that's bad pain you just experienced. That other pain right before that was good pain. You need the good pain in order to develop. The bad pain will destroy you. It's okay to care about our nation till you hurt. That's good pain. It's okay to care about other people until you hurt. That's good pain. It's okay to love. And if you built walls around your life so that you're protecting yourself from pain, you are missing out on what God gave you to do. Because love will always be painful. Imagine God looking at me, how much pain he's in. But he said to me, my grace is sufficient for you. That's what we're told. It is my grace that's sufficient for you, not the circumstances. The circumstances will never be sufficient for you. It's my grace that's sufficient for you. You know what gets me through anything? Here's the fact. My narcolepsy, as I talk to my doctor, my heart is whatever, I say, you know what? This is actually a good thing because I have a Heavenly Father who could heal this thing like right now. And he doesn't. And here's what I know about him. He actually loves me. He actually only does what's right. Therefore, since he doesn't heal it, there's something really good going on here. I just don't get it yet. It's his grace that is sufficient, not my circumstance. My circumstance stinks. I wish I could be more non-narcoleptic, but I'm not. And God's choosing for some reason not to change that. Does that change anything about God? No. What gets me through that? The fact that I'm his child, my position, his grace. That's what gets me through it. And I can go, ooh, there's meaning to this. This suffering has some meaning, man. I don't know what it is. But it's got meaning. I'm not going to pretend like it doesn't. Well, then how can you actually live and enjoy it and not know why? I don't know why in a lot of things. I don't know how television actually comes over the air and goes into my tube. I mean, that's simple to some people, but I don't get it. There's a lot. Don't start me on what I don't know. Here's what I do know. I know the heart of God. I love God. I can trust him. I don't know if I can trust you, but I can trust him. And one day I promise you this. He'll show me. And I will not be disappointed in trusting him. I will not. We need to fully accept self-denial and cross-bearing as a rule of our life. If we're going to be the people we should be, we need to do that. I want to get to the end here soon. I'm coming. All right. 2 Corinthians 1:4. Why? Because he's one who comforts us in all of our afflictions so that we may be able to comfort those in any affliction with the comfort with which we ourselves are comforted by. As I talk to somebody who's going through some rough things, I get to tell them stories. I get to tell them stories about when I was a boy and I got cut from a no-cut baseball team. That's how bad I was. I was in a wheelchair as a kid. I can tell them that story. I can tell them a story about how when I was a boy, I was the kid in the Chicago public school that all the bullies went after. I could tell them that story. I could tell them the fact that I thought I was the misfit of the world. That at Wheaton College, even playing football, that my freshman year, I'd go out and sit on the 50-yard line in the middle of the night and cry. Because I couldn't get good grades and everybody else there did. And I said, God, why'd you make stupid people? I can't do this. I look back on those days now and God was taking me on a journey. And today, guess what I do? I get to talk to young people who have been bullied in wheelchairs, feel like they're stupid. And I could tell you through the rest of my life, but as I look at it, I say, God, wow, you set me up, didn't you? You actually knew what you were doing, didn't you? You made it so that when I get older, I'm able to talk to people and I can actually relate to them. You're pretty smart. Yeah, but it was through all that affliction. Look, my God loved me through all that affliction. I could have listened to other voices and believed that he didn't, but he did. And today I get to comfort others. I get to bring others to him and say, he's not going to run on you. He's not going to lie. I know this. I want you to do three things, just in your own application thing. At first, I want you to decide you're going to be in active duty in this war that we're in, not passive duty. Don't let things just fly by. If we're going to ever change what the church is, and we're ever going to change what's normal, we have to have those who know what's right speak up. They need to say something. Perhaps they should stand up for the truth. I just thought I'd throw that in there. Brownie point with Mike. So many times we haven't made that decision that we are going to take a stand, that we are going to be the one who chooses active duty. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Daniel. Remember the first part of Daniel? They resolved in their heart they would not do evil. Be that person. And when you know what's right, you've resolved, I'm not doing wrong. If I know what's right, I'm not doing wrong. Seek out the things which require of us self-denial. I think that we as a people need to start looking for things that help us understand that it's not about us. I think we should say no to a candy bar once a day. You know, I've always asked God, I don't know, and some of you are probably much better off to talk about this than me. I've always said, God, why this fasting thing, God? What does that do? Really, it makes me hungry. I mean, do I have to fast to show you, God, how important things are? He goes, no, I know how important they are to you without that. All right, then what's the deal here? The only thing I can get is I've never, ever in my life seen that when I say no to myself that it hasn't benefited me somehow. Seriously, I go now and I'm standing at a skyscraper in downtown Chicago. I take the stairs. Why? Because that's the harder way. And I want to take the elevator. You say, you're just a sadist, is what you are. Maybe. I tell young people all the time, you get up in the morning, make your bed. I don't feel like it, exactly. Make it anyway. And make it well. Make it nice. Pick up your clothes. Put them away. Get organized. But Dave, no, deny yourself. What in the world are you doing? Learn to do this. I think I need to choose to be in active duty. I need to seek out things that require self-denial. Not because I want to be ritualistic or legalistic. Don't hear me that way. But because we are people that cannot let our passions control us, and we need to know that they are there. And when you do that, you're just acknowledging that they're there. And your passions will control you. And they hide really well. We justify them really nicely. Third thing, look to Jesus. If you want an example, look to him. Not anybody else in this life. Look to Jesus. Don't look to me. Don't look at somebody. Look to Jesus and say, okay, God, I want Jesus to be my example. See, in John, it tells us, in the beginning was the Word was with God, and the Word was God. All right? In the beginning was the very concept, the very idea of God. Logos. Later in that chapter, and the Word became flesh and dwelt among us so that we could behold the glory of God. See, Jesus showed us how to live. Look at him, would you? Let him be the guide for you on how to act and behave. Look at what he gave up. Look at what he did for others. He didn't need to do any of that to be God. He didn't need to be born in Bethlehem. He could have had a Ritz Carlton birth. He needed to come to Mary. Who is she anyway? He wasn't even married. So he didn't need to die on a cross. We need to look to him. He actually got it. We don't. He actually understood things. We don't. So we need to look to him. Just three simple things. Really, I'm just kind of throwing my heart at you tonight. I would love to see this nation take another course. I don't think that we've got many years left. I know God can't bless us if we keep turning our back on him. I know that. I know he can't bless our church if we keep turning our back on him. I know if we've cleverly made all this about us, he can't bless us. I also know that there's tremendous fruit. Comes in living the way God made us to be. And unless we choose to do that, we'll never be okay. We're going to fight depression. We're going to fight anger. We're going to fight all kinds of things. Because those passions of our soul, those passions will war against our soul. And we need to understand that this world is not our home. We're the sojourners. We're the exiles. We've got a place coming where God will straighten all this out. I hope this has made sense. Let me pray. Father, thank you so much that we could meet together tonight. I thank you for those who made a long journey, and I'm sure people are tired, and they were able to sit through a rather long, wordy presentation. But I pray that your Spirit will use your Word to get into our hearts and allow us to be the people you want us to be. Let this weekend be a special time of renewal, and we look to you to continue to guide and direct. In Jesus' name, amen. We're going to have one more song, and then afterwards, there are cookies, name tags, canteen will be open. We can sit out here and do whatever. And guys with narcolepsy might disappear and go to sleep and see you in the morning. But we'll see what happens. Thank you.